wasn't a mission trip. It was a more of a, my company sent me over there. And we were traveling on a bus with a whole bunch of people from all different, it was a very interesting experience actually, because we were traveling with people from all over the, I wouldn't say all over the world, but there were people there from South America, from the Middle East, from North America, from Australia, not maybe not North America, different places in Asia, Bangladesh. They were dealers for the car dealers from all over. And so as we were traveling on the bus, the Chinese hosts were wanting to make sure everybody was entertained and was not going to get bored. So they had people from different countries come and sing a national anthem or something. They go up front and sing and use the loudspeaker and sing some song that, you know, maybe their national anthem or some song that was popular in their country. You can be certain that I hunkered as low as I could to avoid this. And because that was even worse than this, as far as, you know, it even made me more nervous. And it went on and on. And people would sing and do this thing. And finally, they nailed the guy sitting right next to me. He was from Guatemala, and he said, "I can't do this, but," he said, "I'll let me," that guy sitting back there, sitting next to me, is from Belize. It's almost like Guatemala. Why don't he come up and do it? So I went up, and I was thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. If I have to do this, I don't know what the world, I can't sing the Belize national anthem, and I didn't really want to either anyway. But I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll sing something. I'll sing Amazing Grace." And it's not really an American song. It's an English song. Really, I broke all the rules, but that's the only song I could think of to sing. And the respectful silence that was actually in the bus, and the knees, my knees were shaking like a leaf, and I just could hardly do it. But they were very respectful. These people were Muslims and atheists and everything else, for the most part. I'm trying to remember now if I had actually come in contact with any Christians. I can't remember if there was. Yeah, I guess there was. But anyway, I often think of that experience when we sing the song Amazing Grace. Let's turn to John chapter 1. One of the verses in the Bible that are the most powerful in some ways. John chapter 1, verse 14 says, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." And then in verse 17, it says, "For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ." Now, these are John's words here, written by John, the Apostle John. And he wrote them because he wants us to understand something. And I think he wants us to understand that the law is one thing, grace and truth are something different. This young man that's sitting in the front row here, are you Alexander? And you came to Belize here, you were in Belize a couple weeks ago, and you didn't come see us, so I can't say for sure you're Alexander. But you are, right? You said, "Okay, I'm going to need a little help, so I might ask you to help me, and I just want some answers to some questions." But I'll ask you right now. So we're talking about law. What is law? What is law? Or let me ask you this. We all know what law is. Is law a good thing? Yeah. You don't have to hesitate. Law is a good thing. We have all kinds of law. Laws are simply put, laws are a set of rules that govern our lives, that we live by. Now, do we need laws because we tend to be sinful people and we have to have laws to keep us straight? Is that true? No, it's not true. I don't know what you're thinking, but it's not true. You know, why? How do we know? Because God put some laws in the Garden of Eden before women came. I mean, while everybody was still perfect. Right at the beginning, when to Adam, he said, "Do this, don't do this." That's a law. So there's nothing wrong with law. We don't ever want to get the idea that law is a bad thing. Law is not a bad thing in itself. So law is a part of life. And there's many sets of laws that govern our lives. There's different kinds of laws. There's a civil law. That's the law that if you live in a certain area, you have to abide by this. There's a religious law that you're required to obey if you're part of that religion or denomination, you could say. There are corporate or laws, if you're part of this corporation, you have to follow these rules. There's laws for your house. There's rules. And it's a good thing. And why is it necessary? It's necessary because, well, tell me, why is law necessary? I don't know everybody's name over here, but I know Corey's name, so I'm going to ask her. Corey, why is law? Is law necessary? Yes, it is. But why is it? Why is it necessary? Yeah, it's. Imagine the society without law. That's right. We have to know some things. Law keeps us doing things. Okay, imagine if there were no traffic laws. How many of you have ever got a speeding ticket? Well, no, don't. You don't have to say. But we get a speeding ticket when we break the traffic laws. And sometimes at that moment, we didn't like the law. We hated it that we actually got punished for not. Because if we thought the law was necessary, we'd have been following it. At that moment, we probably thought it wasn't necessary. But imagine if you go out here to 60 right now and you cross the first lane, for the first, the eastbound lane, or yeah, the eastbound lane, and you decide you're going to turn east on the next lane, on the westbound lane. I mean, that would be dangerous and chaotic, and it just wouldn't work well if we didn't have laws. In other words, what I'm just simply saying is that laws are to make so that we have an orderly society. They're for the protection. They're for our protection against bullies and thieves and terrorists. What about if there was a guy in school that simply, he was selfish and mean, and he would just decide if he likes what's in your lunch, he would take it. And if you didn't like it, he'd kick you. And nobody would do anything about it. There was just nothing done about that. Would that be a good thing? Even for the bully, it wouldn't be a good thing. It's not a good thing. There has to be, that law is really a necessary part of our lives. We can imagine what it would be like without law, but some parts of the world don't have to imagine. They experience it. So law is a good thing, and we don't want to say that it's not. Now, when John said that the law came by Moses, he wasn't talking about those kind of laws. He was talking about the laws that were specific to Israel. And he said the law came by Moses, and grace and truth came for Jesus Christ. Now, thinking of Israel's laws, law was not unique to Israel. All the nations had laws in those days, and all the most nations there developed their own laws. I guess they all did, except for Israel. There was no nation like Israel under the whole heaven. The Bible says that. No nation had a God like Israel that could give them laws. Deuteronomy 4, verse 8 says, "And what nation is there so great that hath statutes and judgments so righteous as this law, which I shall set before you this day?" So God himself gave these laws, and these laws reflected in certain aspects the character of God. They reflected his holiness, they reflected his love, they reflected his equity. God doesn't have respect of persons. God is just. So when we say the law of Moses, what we mean by that is it wasn't Moses' law. Moses didn't make up the law, but we mean that God gave the law through Moses. Moses is the one, God gave the law to Moses. Moses spoke the law, and it was called the law of Moses. All right. So And then the Ten Commandments are probably the distillation of the Law of Moses in a lot of ways. The whole book of Deuteronomy is about Moses going over the law with the people before they cross the Jordan into Canaan. And he reminds them of the blessings they'll experience if they keep the law. The law of Moses was a law that governed, the laws we were talking about mostly here this morning were mostly laws that govern our, either our, weren't so much, we were talking about civil laws and we were talking about just social laws, just rules of social behavior. And God's law, the law of Moses, did cover that. It covered civil laws, it covered the social laws, and it also, there were also spiritual laws. That they, the law of God was intended to govern the spiritual aspect of us, because we're not only social beings and we're also spiritual beings, and that law was intended to guide us spiritually as well. And the whole book of Deuteronomy is about Moses going over those laws before they entered into the promised land. Now, were there benefits of keeping those laws? Absolutely there were. The law of Moses was a good thing, as are good laws today. It was a very good thing. And when Israel kept these laws, they prospered in every way. They were victorious over their enemies. They prospered economically. And in Malachi it says, "Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him unto him in Horeb for all Israel with statutes and judgments." And then in 1 Kings, it says, "And keep the charge of the Lord thy God to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes and the commandments and his judgment and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that thou mayest prosper in all that thou doest and whithersoever thou turnest thyself." So there was a blessing in keeping the law. And a very great blessing. And it was in the breaking and forsaking of the law that led Israel again and again and again to fall before their enemies and eventually to be carried away completely in the captivity. And there were three areas, and I think, how many of you like to read the prophets, the major prophets and the minor prophets? How many of that is your favorite reading? All right, how many of... read them sometimes at least. I hope somebody at least reads them sometimes. But I could tell you a little bit of something I think that will help make them more understandable. They're hard to understand. But if you look for three themes when you read through these prophets, almost all of them have the theme that says this. The prophet is preaching and he's saying, "Israel, repent." He says, "If you don't repent, God is going to bring you into judgment." And then they say, "God will bring you into judgment because you're not repenting." And then they say, "But after this, there's going to be a restoration." Those three things almost are you find them in all of them. And the three sins of Israel in those prophets, in those books of the prophets, there's three major sins that they commit. And it causes them to go into captivity. One of those sins is idolatry. And of course, they're breaking the law where it says, "Thou shalt have no other God before me." The Israelites fell into idolatry again and again. That's one of them. The other sin was religious ritualism. Even when they kept the law, they kept the ceremonial law, and they did the sacrifices, and they did their thing, their heart was not in it. They would go through the rituals, but their heart wasn't in it. So we have idolatry, we have religious ritualism, and we have social injustice, where they took advantage of the poor and the foreigners and the widows and the fatherless. And those are the three things. And if you begin to look for those things when you go through the prophets, they start to make more sense. You start to understand them a little bit better, what this is all about. And so when Israel broke those laws, there was terrible consequences. The law had a purpose. It was meant to be obeyed. Obey it and be blessed. Disobey it and suffer the consequences. And there were certainly consequences, and there are consequences. You know that a law is really not a law if there aren't consequences for ignoring it. Otherwise, it's not much. So the strength of any law is its ability to be enforced. If you can't enforce it, it's really not much good. It's not much of a law. So the law is good. We're looking at that. But now we also recognize that the law has some weaknesses. The New Testament talks about that. And as we've already noticed, it's a very good thing. It was given by God, and so it had to be good. It informed the people of God's expectations for them and told them how to fulfill these expectations, but it had some weaknesses. And I'm going to read a few verses in the New Testament that simply states that. Romans 8, verse 3, for what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh. And there's more to the verse, but I wanted to point out that the law was weak through the flesh. Galatians 4, verse 9, but now after that you have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn you again into the weak and beggarly elements whereunto you desire to be in bondage? Talking about returning to the law. And then in Hebrews 7, verses 18 and 19, for there is a disannulling of the commandment going before for the weakness and in unprofitableness thereof. For the law made nothing perfect. And in Galatians chapter 3, verse 11, but that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God, it is evident, for the just shall live by faith. So some of these observations that we want to make now, we want to make several observations, and this is common to all law, not simply to the law of Moses. The weaknesses, we're speaking of the weaknesses of the law. The law could regulate actions. It cannot, or let me say it this way, the law can regulate actions. It cannot regulate attitudes and character of the heart. It can command us, it can command attitudes, correct attitudes, it can command, but it cannot enforce those commandments. For example, thou shalt not steal is a command that can be enforced. It's a law that can be enforced. If someone stole, there's a way to punish and enforce that and make restitution. The law also says thou shalt not covet, but can you really enforce that law? Can you enforce that law, thou shalt not covet? You can really only enforce that law after that has resulted in a wrong action, stealing. The law says thou shalt not commit murder, and if someone did commit murder, there was a way to punish him. The law also said thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Is there really a way to enforce that? So we're saying that there's some weaknesses in the law. Love thy neighbor as thyself can only be punished, or the lack of love for your neighbor can only be punished after there's a wrong action. The law says thou shalt not have any other gods before me. Idolatry was severely punished when it resulted in actual idolatry. But the Lord also said, the law also says, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart. And again, there's really no way to enforce that until lack of love for God results in an action that also broke the law. So the law could regulate actions. It cannot really regulate the heart. That's one of the weaknesses. Now, another weakness of the law is that it can actually provoke rebellion in a heart that is unregenerate and sometimes in a heart that we would think would be regenerate. You know, Romans 7, I'll read a few verses. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Nay, I had not known sin but by the law, for I had not known lust except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. But sin, taking occasion by the commandment, wrought in me all manner of concupiscence, for without the law sin was dead. For I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment which was ordained to life I found to be unto death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it slew me. A dark look at the law there, what it does. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. So we've probably experienced that ourselves. We might be happy to do something, we're happy to do it, until somebody tells us we have to do it. And depending on how they tell us we have to do it, we just don't want to do it anymore. Is that true? Do you ever have that? Did that ever happen to you? You were okay doing it until somebody said you had to do it, and then you didn't really want to do it anymore. Does that ever happen? If it doesn't happen, I'm just talking to the wrong crowd, I guess. But if it just happens, be honest and say it's happened to me already. Okay. It does. All right. Even among the mature ladies of our church sometimes have no problem with having a fellowship dinner. They love it. We all love it. But if you try to organize it and say, you bring this and you bring that and you bring this, well, you've got a problem on your hands. So it's just because it's just that when we're told to do something sometimes, we don't want to do it. There's something about us. So the law can actually provoke rebellion in a heart that's not quite what it ought to be. I think that's at least why it is. Or maybe it's just because we're human. I don't know. But we've likely experienced that. But law can, that's one of the weaknesses. Law can also mask motives. When a good thing is required by law and people do it, we can never be certain if someone is doing it because it's a good thing or because it's required. Isn't that true? Whenever you have a law for something, it's a good thing, but you're never sure if the person is doing it because they have to or because they want to. Are they doing it because it's right and good, or are they doing it because they have to? So law can mask motives. We're just looking at some of the weaknesses here. The law can breed self-righteousness. People trust the law for their righteousness and become self-righteous, maybe technically keeping the law, but in reality their hearts are far from what God wants them to be. The law tends to build on itself. If law is good, then more law is better, and more law is better, and the laws keep piling up, more and more and more laws. The law was temporary. It was provisional. It was never intended to be the final solution for the redemption of men. We're thinking about the weaknesses of the law. The law is a shadow, the Bible says. For the law, having a shadow of good things to come and not the very image of the things, can never with the sacrifices which they offered year by year continually make the comers thereunto perfect. That's in Hebrews 10. And in Galatians 3 again, wherefore the law was our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ that we might be justified by faith. Now, it isn't saying that we come to Christ through the keeping of the law, but it's saying that the law was intended to show us how much we need Christ. So where is the weakness of the law? The weakness isn't in the character of the law itself. The weakness is in its inability to change the heart, in its inability to change the human heart. So in many ways, the weakness of the law is not really, the law's weakness is not really any weakness in the law itself, but it's in our weakness. The law is not the problem. We are the problem. And the law can't solve our problem. But the good thing about it, the law does show our problem, and that's what it was intended to do. It was intended to show us how we need Christ. So in some very real ways, the law reflected the character of God. In other ways, it seems to almost have more to do with making provision for the weakness of men. Now, I'd like to read I'd like to think now about grace. It says that the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. And in speaking of Christ, it says, and the child grew and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. And that's in Luke 2. Now, what is grace? Let me read this yet. Moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound. Okay, so everything is fine. Everybody's fine, but the law comes in and shows that everything is not fine. We might think that everything is, you've seen it over and over again, that things are going along and nobody really notices that something is really all that far out of line until somebody sets a standard, somebody puts a line. Then we see how far off it is. So it says there, moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. So what is grace? Grace is what God does. Grace, I think, is four things. Grace is divine influence. And for an example, we read Acts chapter 4, verse 33. And with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and the grace of God was upon them. I think it means that the influence of God was upon them. Grace is divine influence. Grace is divine favor. Grace is divine provision. And in Titus chapter 2, verse 11, it says, the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared unto all men. And grace is divine enablement. Four things: divine influence, divine favor, divine provision, divine enablement. And divine simply means that it comes from God. It's something that is from God. Now, I think it's interesting to notice, and I think it's fascinating to notice, that the very first time that grace is mentioned in the Bible is the story of Noah. And the story of Noah is that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And I think what I find fascinating is that in this story, we find every aspect of grace, those four aspects that I mentioned. And I didn't really notice that until very lately, that in the story of Noah, we find all four aspects of grace demonstrated there. Noah was a righteous man in the middle of a whole lot of wickedness. That is divine influence. That is God's influence on Noah in spite of all that wickedness that was around him. So that was divine influence. God looked down at Noah and said, we're going to have to get rid of all this wickedness, but we're going to save Noah and his family. That's divine favor. God told Noah to build a huge boat to survive the great flood. That's divine provision. Noah built a boat big enough to fit his family and hundreds of animals into, and strong enough to hold up at the worst storm ever. Noah's family lived in there with him and all those animals, and with their in-laws for a whole year. That is divine enablement. Old Testament grace. The next time the word is used in the Old Testament, it's the story of Lot. The story of Lot and the story of Noah are two different stories, two different characters. So Lot's talking to God, and when he says, he acknowledges that God has shown him mercy by rescuing him from Sodom. Now, Lot was different from Noah in many ways, and he wasn't saved because he was a righteous man. Noah, I think you could argue that he was saved because he was a righteous man. I don't think you could argue that for Lot, even though the Bible calls him a righteous man in Peter. It doesn't say that he was saved because he was righteous. He was saved because of Abraham's intervening for him and his intercession for him. And so here we have a little different aspect of grace. Here we have an aspect of grace that somebody got some favor that he really didn't deserve. And in the Old Testament, the word grace is found 39 times. And by far, most of those times give you the idea of a little bit Noah's kind of grace. The kind of grace that, most of the times they refer to somebody doing something to gain the favor of someone else. So Jacob sends a gift to Esau, to his brother Esau. He sends a whole bunch of, to Esau, and he says, I'm doing this to find grace in your sight. Ruth works hard to take care of her mother-in-law, and she finds grace. David is friends with Jonathan, and he finds grace. And there are a few exceptions, but the main idea of grace in the Old Testament is where grace is extended to those who are in some way deserving. New Testament grace, the story is completely reversed. In the New Testament, there are also two words that are translated grace. In the Old Testament, there's two Hebrew words that are translated grace. One time, it talks about mercy, and many of the other times, it has to do with extending favor or something like that, or that. But in the New Testament, it's also, there's two Greek words that are translated grace, and one of them means beauty, and it's found in James chapter 1 verse 11, the grace of the fashion of it perisheth. It's talking about the flowers or grass. But the rest of the times, it's talking about it, the word means gift, and like the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared unto all men. That's a gift. It's talking about the salvation. It almost always refers to salvation. Abide in the grace of God is a theme that's repeated over and over again. So the main difference between the use of grace in the Old Testament and the use of grace in the New Testament is the thought of merit. In the Old Testament, grace is a reward. In the New Testament, grace is a gift. And how is reward different from a gift? Somebody help me. How is a reward different from a gift? A reward, you earn it in some way. You won a prize. You did something and you got it. A gift is just a gift. You just get it. Somebody gives it to you. It's not something you earned necessarily. So overwhelmingly in the New Testament, when it's talking about grace, it's talking about something that you get without deserving it at all. How is grace different from law? Grace, law controls actions, but is powerless to control the heart. Grace, on the other hand, intervenes in the heart before the wrong action takes place. Grace works with covetousness before it results in stealing. Grace works with anger before it results in hate and murder. It works with lust before it results in adultery. Romans 5, verse 20, again, the law entered that the offense might abound, but where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. The law sowed the offense. Grace showed how to come out of there. The law showed you that you needed to come out. Grace says how to come out. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 28. And we can see that happening again and again. You break the law, you die many times. What does grace do? Grace is an extension. It's not an exception. Grace doesn't make exceptions. You know, God has a standard. And the whole thing of the law in the Old Testament was to bring people to God's standard. And God has a standard that has in no way diminished. He wants us to be holy like he's holy. Everything he does is about making us like he is and restoring us to how he created us in the first place, restoring us to that original purpose. And so God didn't lower, the grace is not about God lowering his standard, not a bit of it. That's the wrong way to think about grace. But it's about, so it's no exception. Grace isn't an exception. But it can be an extension. Now, when you're given a grace period to pay your phone bill, you forgot to pay it, and they give you a grace period, does that mean that you don't have to pay your phone bill? Absolutely not. When God gives us grace, when we fail and God gives us grace, does that mean it's just okay to fail? It's okay. It's okay. You don't have to live up to the standard? No. It means he's going to give you an extension. He's going to give you some time. He's going to give you help. Let's look at, so there's two aspects of it. There's the time to get it right, and there's the power to get it right. Now let's think about school. Using the analogy of school, if a student fails to prepare for a test, he's likely to fail the test. So when he fails, the teacher could ethically choose to extend grace to him in two ways. If she just simply gives him a passing grade when he failed, is there anything good about that? What do you think? David, what do you think? The teacher, you failed the test, you didn't study, the teacher likes you, she gives, and so you get 50%. The teacher likes you, so she gives you 90%. Is there anything good about that? Absolutely not. It's not a good thing. And if teachers shouldn't do it, do you think God's going to do it? Absolutely not. If we fail, he's not going to say, oh, I'm going to give you 100% because I love you. He won't do that. But he will do something else. A teacher could ethically say, well, we want to extend grace to this student. And so we're going to give him another opportunity. And that's giving an extension. But we could do more than that. We can help him prepare. Maybe he's having a hard time. Maybe he was so discouraged about this thing that he didn't even prepare because he just thought it was impossible. So she can help him. She can study with him. She can help him prepare in a lot of ways. Well, that's a bit crude, but that's a lot the way God works with us. He gives us the time. He's not demanding that we are exactly... Well, he gives us time to get where he wants us to be, and he gives us help. Grace means that there's more than one opportunity to take the test, but it doesn't mean we don't have to take it. It doesn't mean we can skip the test, but God helps us get ready. And that's what the grace of God does for us. It gives us time, gives us help, but we still need to take the test. Now, what is the test? What's the test? The test is a godly life. A life that honors Jesus. A life that imitates Jesus. A life that shuns evil and strife and ill will and hatred. A life that loves his enemies. If you don't love your enemies, an enemy is not someone that you hate. Some people say they don't have any enemies. Well, that's great, but good people have enemies sometimes. And enemies doesn't mean that you hate someone. It means that someone hates you, doesn't hate you, but tries to do you harm, and you almost have to hate someone to do them harm, to want to harm them. So grace helps you to love your enemies. But grace might help you love your enemies, but it doesn't take away the requirement to love your enemies. God doesn't just say, well, I know that guy's really hard to love, so I guess you don't have to. No. Grace means he'll enable you to do it. There's the grace that forgives us for not being what we ought to be, and there's the grace that helps us become what we ought to be. There's the grace that overlooks our imperfections. There's a grace that helps us toward perfection. We need both. And they both come from God. There's some wrong ways to understand grace, and we mentioned one of those, and that is that God just lowers the standard for some people. God doesn't lower the standard. God gives us grace to meet the standard. And what is the standard? The standard is finding the purpose that God has for us, to being what he wants us to be. So we can live as if we're under the law, and we have a tendency to do that, maybe more than we think. The Galatians did that. Or we can live under grace. How can we experience more grace? Now we look at those aspects of grace, the divine influence and favor and provision and enablement. How can we experience more grace? Is there something we can do to incur God's favor? Well, you know, that kind of puts us in a little bit of a trap when we start thinking about that in a way, or we kind of go in a circle. We say, well, then if I do this, then I'm not really doing it. It's not really grace, it's merit, because I'm doing this to earn God's favor so that he gives me grace, and then it's not really grace. And that's kind of true. But on the other hand, let's think of it a little different way. Grace is not about merit. It's not about merit. But grace is about intentionally aligning ourselves with God's purpose for our lives. Grace is about that. Intentionally aligning ourselves with God's purpose for our lives. Will we live under the law, or will we live under grace?